Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Siege of Tyre, Alexander the Great and the Gateway to Empire, by David A. Gunter. Narrated by Julian Elfer. A note on sources, names and dates. Over the last 23 centuries, few people in the Western world have been written about more than King Alexander III of ancient Macedonia, Alexander the Great. Yet despite this long-standing celebrity, there exist today no first-hand accounts of the events of his life. Virtually everything we know about Alexander comes to us from preserved writings of Greek and Roman historians, all of whom lived and wrote hundreds of years after Alexander's death. The story that is retold in this book is based on the writings of five of these historians known to us as Arrian, Curtius, Diodorus, Justin, and Plutarch, with the first three providing most of the information pertaining to the Siege of Tyre. While these writers had access to accounts written by Alexander's contemporaries, in some cases written by men who had accompanied the Macedonian army on its epic march across the Persian Empire, those sources are lost to us. In writing this book, I have relied on four translations of Arrian's Anabasis of Alexander. Three of these translations are Arrian, Anabasis of Alexander, translated P.A. Brunt, Martin Hammond, translated Arrian, Alexander the Great, the Anabasis and the Indica, James Ron, editor, The Landmark Arrian, The Campaigns of Alexander, translated by Pamela Mensch. The text of Arrian quoted in Appendix B is from E.J. Chinnock, translator, The Anabasis of Alexander, or The History of the Wars and Conquests of Alexander the Great, literally translated with a commentary from the Greek of Arrian the Nicomedean. According to the editors of the Oxford Handbook of Warfare in the Classical World, the spelling and presentation of Greek names and technical terms is a thorny issue over which scholars continue to wrangle, much to the confusion of non-specialists. For the names of people and places mentioned in this book, I have used those that I thought would be most familiar to modern English speakers. For example, Alexander, rather than the Greek Alexandros, Asia Minor and Greece. In many cases, the names with which we are most familiar are the ones that came down to us from those used by the ancient Greeks or Romans. For example, the Greeks referred to the people of Tyre and other coastal cities of the eastern Mediterranean as Phoenikes, plural of Phoenics, the Phoenicians, whereas the people living in Tyre would not have used that term to describe themselves. We call them Phoenicians, and we call Iranians Persians, because that's what the Greeks called them. The Phoenicians living in Tyre called their city Sur, from the Semitic word for rock. The Greeks called it Tyros, and the Romans Tyrus. Throughout the book, I refer to Alexander's homeland as Macedonia rather than Macedon, although some scholars prefer the latter term. The word uncertain is used often in this book because serious scholars disagree about many of the basic facts relating to Alexander and his campaign. For example, how long was the sarissa, the feared weapon of the Macedonian phalanx? Where exactly was the Panaros River, site of the Battle of Issus? Were the walls of Tyre really 150 feet high? How were the oars and rowers of a quinquirim arranged? In cases like these, I present all of the scholarly views and let the listener decide, although I have attempted to identify which views seem to reflect consensus. All dates given are BC unless otherwise noted. I follow the standard format for citing classical prose sources: book number, chapter number, and, if applicable, section within a chapter. For example, Arrian, Anabasis of Alexander, 1:18:5 refers to book 1, Chapter 18, Section 5. Introduction. This book tells the story of how Alexander the Great ended the naval power of the Persian Empire. In 334, at the start of Alexander's campaign, the Persian fleet was the most powerful naval force in the world. The Greek historian Arrian writes that the Persians had 400 warships, all first-class ships with experienced crews from the maritime provinces of the empire, Phoenicia, Cyprus, Egypt, and the coastal cities of Asia Minor. Their decks loaded with marines and well-paid veteran Greek mercenary infantry. Alexander knew he couldn't leave this powerful force at his back to threaten Greece and Macedonia while he marched into Asia. Yet to oppose them, Alexander had a mere 160 ships, his own Macedonians plus a cobbled-together force of Greek allies of questionable loyalty. He knew he could never defeat the Persians in a naval battle. So he didn't try. Instead, he adopted the strategy of defeating the Persian navy from the land. His plan was to capture the coastal cities that were the home bases of the ships in the Persian fleet, the places where the ships were resupplied and repaired, where the crews were recruited, and where the families of the sailors and marines had their homes. Robin Lane Fox writes that this strategy needed 2 years' faith and patience to succeed, and that it was shot through with short-term danger. Nevertheless, finance and numbers made it the one sound option. Alexander, at least, had the foresight and daring to pursue it to its hazardous end. The end was indeed hazardous. It came 2 years later at the Phoenician city of Tyre. Prologue. The Prophecy. The modern city of Tyre occupies a narrow peninsula on the eastern shore of the Mediterranean Sea, clinging like a barnacle to the Lebanese coast. But 23 centuries ago, at the time the events described in this book occurred, Tyre was an island, small and rocky, separated from shore by half a mile of sometimes stormy sea. For centuries, the kings of Tyre maintained good relations with their Canaanite neighbours, including, to the south, the biblical kingdoms of Israel and Judah. In Jerusalem, King Solomon may have relied on skilled craftsmen and engineers from Tyre for the construction of his temple, using cedar beams and other building materials supplied by Tyre. He may have incorporated design elements from Tyre's temples as well. In the Kingdom of Israel, King Ahab's wife Jezebel, whose prophets of Baal famously clash with the prophet Elijah in 1 Kings 18, was a royal princess of Tyre, and her god Baal was a Phoenician deity. In the year 587, a Babylonian army destroyed Jerusalem and sent the inhabitants into exile. Tyre reportedly responded to this Judean disaster with glee, seeing it as the removal of a trading rival and an opportunity to expand its influence in the region. In Babylon, the news of Tyre's joyful response to Jerusalem's destruction incensed one of the exiled Jews, a man we know as the prophet Ezekiel. Ezekiel's anger, and perhaps a voice from God, compelled him to make the following prophecy. "The word of the Lord came to me, Son of man, because Tyre said concerning Jerusalem, Aha, the gate of the peoples is broken, it has swung open to me, I shall be replenished, now that she is laid waste. Therefore, thus says the Lord God, Behold, I am against you, O Tyre, and will bring up many nations against you, as the sea brings up its waves. They shall destroy the walls of Tyre and break down her towers, and I will scrape her soil from her and make her a bare rock." Ezekiel chapter 6, verses 2 through 4, Revised Standard Version. Ezekiel goes on to explain who will be the agent of Tyre's destruction. "I will bring upon Tyre from the north Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, king of kings, with horses and chariots, and with horsemen and a host of many soldiers. He will slay with the sword your daughters on the mainland. He will set up a siege wall against you and throw up a mound against you and raise a roof of shields against you. He will direct the shock of his battering rams against your walls, and with his axes he will break down your towers. Your stones and timber and soil they will cast into the midst of the waters." Ezekiel chapter 26, verses 7 through 12, Revised Standard Version. Ezekiel's prophecy continues on in this vein for quite a while, through chapters 27 and 28, and includes this line. "Behold, I will bring strangers upon you, the most terrible of the nations, and they shall draw their swords against the beauty of your wisdom and defile your splendor." Ezekiel chapter 28, verse 7, Revised Standard Version. We know with hindsight that Ezekiel was only partially correct in his prophecy. Although Nebuchadnezzar did besiege Tyre for 13 years, 585 to 572, the island city was never captured. The Babylonians never broke down Tyre's towers and walls, never cast Tyre's stones and timber and soil into the midst of the waters. Nebuchadnezzar wasn't the most terrible of the nations that God had in mind. But God is nothing if not patient. After 250 years, other strangers did come to Tyre, and they weren't Babylonians. They came from Macedonia, the wild land to the north of Greece. They were fierce and bold and reckless, an army the likes of which the world had never seen, carving their way across Asia, straight through the might of the Persian Empire. They were led by a 23-year-old military genius who thought he was a god. To his men, perhaps he was. His name was Alexander, and he was coming for Tyre. Part 1. The Long March. Arrian, Diodorus, Quintus Curtius, Plutarch and Justin, despite their diversity, all furnish a Greek memory of the event, and the silence of Phoenician sources deprives us of any comparison. Furthermore, these accounts are largely posterior to the event. They fall more under the genre of heroic history, of myths associated with the sometimes revered, sometimes criticized figure of Alexander the Conqueror, founder of an empire that was as ephemeral as it was memorable. Corinne Bonnet, The Hellenistic Period and Hellenization in Phoenicia, in the Oxford Handbook of the Phoenician and Punic Mediterranean. 1. The Syrian Gates. It was early morning in the fall of 333, late October or early November, the exact date is uncertain, and the veteran soldiers of Alexander's Macedonian army awoke to find they were in serious trouble. It wasn't that their location was bad. They were camped near the seaside town of Myriandrus on the Gulf of Issus, nearly 300 miles north of Tyre. The gulf was formed where the southern coast of Asia Minor, part of the province of Cilicia, makes a sharp right turn to become the coast of northern Syria, part of the large province with the odd name beyond the river, Akkadian Eber Nari, which covered all of the lands of the Persian Empire west of the Euphrates River. A short distance to the east of their camp, the men could see foothills of the Amanus mountain range running north-south along the coast, isolating the narrow strip of shoreline on which the army was camped from the inland expanse of the Syrian plain beyond. The men had just endured a punishing 2-day forced march, trying to reach a strategic pass through those mountains, called the Syrian Gates, before the Persian army of King Darius III could block it. Although Alexander had no maps, he would have known from Xenophon's Anabasis that his army could travel from Lalos in Cilicia, where he first received news of the location of Darius's army, to Myriandrus at the Syrian Gates in 2 days of hard marching. Xenophon recorded his march through this same area in 401 as consisting of 25 parasangs. There is no general agreement among historians as to whether a Persian parasang is a unit of time or of distance. Robin Lane Fox argues 25 parasangs would be equivalent to 25 hours of hard marching. However, Donald W. Engels argues that it would be impossible for the army to march from Malus to Myriandrus in 2 days. He suggests the 2-day march began at the town of Issus, about halfway between Malus and Myriandrus. P. A. Brunt writes that in counting the 2 days of the march, it is probable that the counting begins at a place between Malus and Myriandrus. A heavy rainstorm during the night had halted the army's progress at Myriandrus, near the western entrance to the Syrian Gates, and now, before they could resume their march, shocking news arrived in a grisly fashion. One version of the story is told by the Roman historian Quintus Curtius Rufus in his History of Alexander. According to Curtius, on the previous day a small party of sick and injured Macedonians had been left at a makeshift field hospital in the town of Issus. There the men had been captured by Persians who had brutally cut off their hands and cauterized the bleeding stumps with red-hot irons. Curtius uses the Latin word adustis, singed or burnt. On the orders of the Persian king, the mutilated men were shown the vast size of the Persians' encampment and then released, the expectation being that they would spread fear throughout Alexander's army. A few of these men survived their mutilation and walked all night in the rain to reach the Macedonian camp and warn their comrades of the danger. Alexander's veteran soldiers, although hardened to the brutality of warfare, were stunned and angered by what had been done to these men, but they were also confused. The Persian king and his army were supposed to be on the other side of the mountains, on the Syrian plain, where Alexander was hurrying to confront them. So what Persians had committed this atrocity? Where had they come from? And worst of all, what were they doing behind the Macedonian army? Alexander had been so certain that the Persians were still camped east of the mountains, where they had last been detected, that he hadn't kept track of their subsequent movements. When he heard that Darius and his army were behind him, at first he refused to believe the news. He ordered some of his men to take a ship and sail north along the coast, back the way the army had marched the day before, and find out exactly who these Persians were and, more importantly, where they were. The report came back quickly. A vast Persian army occupied the coastal plain just to their north, less than a day's march to their rear, blocking the narrow passage that ran between the sea on the west and the mountains on the east. The Persians were behind them, cutting them off from their line of retreat, cutting them off from the Greek cities on the Aegean coast of Asia Minor, and cutting them off from Macedonia and home. According to J.F.C. Fuller, there can be little doubt that Alexander had blundered badly. Over-eagerness had led him into a trap. Not only was the army cut off, but the men were worn out from the 2 days of hard marching, some of it in the rain. There were signs that the local inhabitants were keeping the Persian scouts well informed about Alexander's movements. None of them thought the Macedonians had much of a chance. What had happened was one of those odd coincidences that seemed to occur with surprising frequency throughout military history. The Persians, who had been camped east of the mountains on the Syrian plain, believed Alexander to be in southern Asia Minor, farther north and to the west of the mountains. The Macedonian army had indeed been camped there for several weeks while Alexander recovered from a fever. To reach them, the Persians needed to cross the mountains, and they did so using a northern pass called the Amanic Gates, which was a different pass from the Syrian gates that Alexander planned to use. So while Alexander was marching his army south along the Syrian coast, on the west side of the mountains, heading toward the Syrian gates, the Persian army was marching north on the east side of the mountains, heading toward the Amanic gates. Neither army was aware of the movements of the other. The Persians came west through the mountains and out onto the coastal plain near Issus, where they found that Alexander and his army had passed through the day before. In one of ancient history's most inexplicable military blunders, Alexander's failed reconnaissance had completely missed his intended target, and he remained oblivious to the nearby Persian threat as he urged his army rapidly down the coast road toward Mariandrus. Alexander doesn't appear to have been unduly worried by the news that the Persians were now behind him. He gathered the army's leaders together and tried to shore up their confidence by reminding them of past successes in the face of tough odds. As generals have done throughout history, he assured them that the gods were on their side and that their strategy was sound, giving them a speech that inspired and encouraged them and their men. Then he ordered the army to rest and eat, after which he turned them around and headed back north along the narrow coastal road beside the mountains toward where the Persians were waiting. Reading Alexander's speech today, a modern reader gets the impression that rather than feeling trapped by the Persians, he now had them exactly where he wanted them, close to hand and easy to find. He didn't care that they were behind him. He just wanted to get at them and kill them. Exactly where that happened didn't really matter. 2. Men who dine on sharpened swords. The story of how Alexander and his army ended up on the border of Syria, cut off from home and seemingly trapped by the Persians, begins a year and a half earlier, in spring 334, when the army was ferried across the Hellespont, modern Dardanelles, from Europe to Asia Minor by the Greek and Macedonian ships of Alexander's fleet. In making the crossing, the Macedonians used cargo ships and 160 triremes. The triremes were fast, oared warships, but they were long and narrow and had limited space for the soldiers and horses of Alexander's army. Some of the triremes would have been modified and reconfigured into transports by removing rowing benches, sacrificing speed for space. Other triremes would likely have towed the slower cargo ships. Alexander himself, accompanied by 60 warships, sailed to the site of Homeric Troy, where he landed and made sacrifices. Some of these 60 ships were triremes, while some may have been larger warships of Alexander's personal squadron. The army and navy that Alexander led to Asia Minor were technically part of an allied Greek force operating under terms of an alliance between Macedonia and most of the city-states of mainland Greece. The alliance had been formed 4 years earlier in 338 by Alexander's father, Philip II of Macedonia. Following Philip's victory over a Greek army at the Battle of Chaeronea. At a critical point in that battle, 18-year-old Alexander achieved his first military success by personally leading a charge that shattered the famed Sacred Band of Thebes, thus ensuring the victory. Philip's victory on the battlefield effectively ended Greek resistance to Macedonian hegemony and resulted in the formation of the Council of Corinth, at which Philip was proclaimed leader of the forces of the Greek alliance. Philip's goal in uniting the Greeks was to bring about a combined Macedonian-Greek army and navy that he would lead in a campaign against the Persian Empire, at that time the largest empire the world had ever known. Under its current king, Darius III, the Persian Empire stretched north to south from the Black Sea to the southern border of Egypt and west to east from the shores of the Aegean Sea to beyond the Hindu Kush mountains of Afghanistan. Philip's stated reason for the campaign was to avenge wrongs committed against the Greeks during the invasion by the Persian king Xerxes in 480, when Greek temples were said to be desecrated and the city of Athens was burned. Philip's real motivation is unclear, although it may have simply been his belief that Persia at that time was militarily weak and ripe for conquest. Greek victories on land and at sea during decades of conflict with Persia may have given Philip confidence that despite the Persian Empire's vast size, its armies could easily be overcome by Greek valour, arms and tactics. Philip had made careful preparations for the campaign against Persia, including sending an advance force to Asia Minor to seize and hold a bridgehead. The Persians pushed them back but left the Macedonians clinging to a thin stretch of Asian coastline, primed for a future invasion. Unfortunately for Philip, he was assassinated in 336 before the campaign could begin, and so the responsibility fell to his son and heir, Alexander, who was acclaimed leader of the Greek allied force. Two Greek city-states were notably absent from the allied army. One, Sparta, refused to take part in any military action in which a Spartan general was not in command. Alexander let them go, believing a war against Sparta was not worth the trouble. The Spartans would continue to be a thorn in Alexander's side, creating a distraction during the early part of the campaign through their continued overtures to Persia. The other Greek city-state not taking part was Thebes, which, at the news of Philip's death, had rebelled against the forced alliance, and as a consequence the city had been sacked and destroyed by Alexander as both a punishment to the Thebans and a warning to the other Greeks. With that accomplished, the allied army set off to war. Alexander's army was what would today be termed a combined arms force, comprising several different types of units, each having a specific function. Combining these different units created a force that was more flexible and powerful than anyone would be individually. There were heavily armed cavalry squadrons for massed shock attack and lightly armed squadrons for reconnaissance and skirmishing. There were armored infantry battalions in slow-moving massed formations and light infantry skirmishers, able to move quickly over rough, uneven terrain. There were archers and slingers and javelin men to attack from a distance, and engineers and siege equipment for breaking into fortified cities. It was all Philip's creation. Victor Davis Hanson writes of the Macedonian army, "They were quick and travelled lightly," which fit perfectly with Alexander's style of leadership. They were also brutal. Hanson writes that the Macedonians were known as thugs by the polis Greeks. In Demosthenes' words, they were little more than beasts who always had their hands on weapons. The Greek playwright Mnesimachos wrote a comedy poking fun at Philip and his hard-bitten soldiers, portraying them as men for whom fighting is as natural as eating. "Do you realize that your fight is against men who dine on sharpened swords and gulp down flaming torches as a delicacy?" is part of one line from the play. The core of Alexander's army was the Macedonian heavy infantry, the phalanx, sometimes referred to as the foot companions. The phalanx typically formed up in dense rectangular units that were 16 ranks deep, but these could be combined into deeper rectangles of 32 or 64 ranks when necessary. Unlike the typical citizen soldiers mustered by the Greek city-states, these were highly trained full-time professionals, and they could march and move in formation like a modern drill team. Their armor was similar to that of classical Greek hoplites: shields, Greek aspis, bronze helmets, chorus, and cuirasses, thorax, of bronze, leather, or linen to protect the upper body, although it may be the case that only the first few ranks of the phalanx wore cuirasses. Minor M. Markle argues that there is no evidence Macedonian infantry wore cuirasses at all, and Nick Secunda writes, Most modern authorities do not believe that the infantry was so heavily equipped. The primary weapon of the phalanx was a long pike. There is some question as to whether the men had greaves, Greek kinemis, for leg protection and carried swords, xiphos. Fuller writes that they wore leggings and carried a short sword. Lane Fox writes that the front rank probably sported greaves against enemy missiles, and that the men wore short daggers on their hips that were very much a last resort. Secunda writes, "We can probably assume that all the infantry were issued with swords." Simon Anglim et al. Write, "Muscled greaves were also common, and it is likely that knives or short swords would have been carried." Philip had introduced two innovations that drastically increased the fighting power of the Macedonian phalanx. First, the traditional spear carried by Greek heavy infantry was discarded in favour of a much longer pike called a sarissa, Greek sarissa or sarissa, approximately 18 feet long, with a foot-long iron blade and a metal butt spike for balance. There is some uncertainty about the length of the Macedonian sarissa used by Alexander's men. Here are some estimates by modern scholars. 13 to 14 feet in length, Fuller. Its longest variety was 18 feet long, Lane Fox. These tough spears were riveted together to a length of 16 feet, Lane Fox. According to Polybius, the sarissa was 6 to 7 metres, 19.4 to 23 feet long, Anglim et al. The longest sarissae measured 12 cubits, 18 feet, Secunda. Nearly 18 feet and more, Hansen. Varied in length only between about 4.5 and 5.5 metres, Markle. It is not possible to give a precise measurement, as estimates vary, John Worry. Philip's second innovation was to reduce the size and weight of the traditional Greek round infantry shield so his men could carry it on their back or left shoulder, slung by a strap around the neck, thus freeing both hands to wield the sarissa. Regardless of length, the sarissa was undoubtedly heavy and difficult to control, requiring two hands to wield effectively. But in the hands of Alexander's highly drilled phalanx, the weapon presented any enemy with a bristling forest of sharpened iron blades protruding from the first five ranks, presenting a hedgehog-like front and looking like the quills of a metal porcupine. A second infantry component in the Macedonian army was a unit called the shield-bearers, Greek hypaspists. The exact nature and armament of the shield-bearers has long been the subject of scholarly debate. Here are some arguments made by modern scholars. They had better armour and shorter pikes, and they were usually the first infantry forces to follow behind the cavalry. Hansen. How the shield-bearers were armed and equipped is not known. Fuller. It is logical to assume that they were more lightly equipped than the foot companions. Secunda. Ancient sources do not describe the shield-bearers in any detail, and many historians presume that they simply formed an elite unit within the phalanx, while others see them as commando-type light infantry. Anglim et al. The part of the Macedonian infantry under Alexander the Great, normally armed with the hoplite panoply, were the shield-bearers. Markle. The shield-bearers, because of their name, likely carried a large hoplite shield that required the use of their left hand and arm, and thus ruled out wielding a sarissa. However, the fact that the shield-bearers were often selected for fast pursuits suggests they could leave behind their heavy armour and fight as light infantry when necessary. Lane Fox considers the shield-bearers to be the most lethal troops in Alexander's army and calls them the finest foot force in antiquity. The army also contained allied Greek soldiers. The League of Corinth provided 7,000 heavily armed hoplites from the various member city-states and also 5,000 mercenaries, both hoplites and light infantry. James Rom argues that the allied Greek soldiers were classed as allies but essentially hostages. He writes that their contribution to the army was minimal, since they fought with spears rather than the sarissa, and that they were included in the expedition to ensure that their home cities in Greece remained loyal to Alexander. Philip also raised troops from the peoples living on the borders of Macedonia, Thracians, Paeonians, and Illyrians. Several different types of light infantry units formed an important part of Alexander's army. To provide missile weapons, Philip had hired archers from Crete and slingers from Rhodes. According to Fuller, the Cretans were reputed to be the most skilled bowmen of their day. But the best light infantrymen were the javelin-armed skirmishers from a tribe called the Agrianians, or Agrianes, whose homeland was in the southwest corner of present-day Bulgaria. They were referred to as Peltas because of the type of shield they carried, and Lane Fox calls them the Gurkhas of the Macedonian army.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?